Here, dear.
Lids Hutchinson's January Thaw, and now we're getting Marion Hammond, A Lot to Answer For.
It's behind.
his port distraction, what makes up the silence?
Marion Hammond, and now we're having Viv Dogan Cunningham, Mele Honua. It lasts for 7 minutes.
Kismet viziyor.
Very hot, and I don't want it to get overheated. And we will, this is what is known as the housekeeping of radio, which is making sure that everything is going to be okay. Well, I know what I should have done, I should have turned it off. Anyway, so there we are. And this is a Radio Pirate Woman. If anyone has just tuned in, and it's a bit of what is known as a random radio. Just taking plugs out. A bit of a random radio. Now, the first part, I have to apologise, even though we're advertised for 10 o'clock, because of interferences, I've had to postpone it till 11 o'clock. And I will be putting an ad in the Galway Advertiser, and I think just to make absolutely sure, I think I'll revert back to what I used to do, which is midnight. because there's loads of scaffolding around here, and they're building whole new blocks of apartments that seem to have really messed up my aerial, with the result it interferes with my next door neighbour's television and video, which is rather surprising. I mean, I would have thought I could understand the television, but not the actual video. And I rang up somebody about aerials, and he can't come till the end of the week. And I think he thinks I've got an indoor aerial. I don't think he realizes that I've got a great big aerial on the roof, and in these gales, there's not very much. It certainly would be dangerous for him to go on top of the roof. So, if you're tuning in, do not tune in until 11 o'clock. Now, it gets a bit complicated because on Friday night, my neighbor goes out, and she doesn't come in until 11 o'clock. So on Friday, I will be broadcasting from 10 to 11, then I'll go off the air from 11 to 12, and then I'll continue on again. So we'll have to wait till next week for you to get the information. So if anyone tunes in, wants to hear what's going on. Now, part of the process of the broadcasting is that I was at the UN in March, and what I'm doing is taping the various seminars and speeches I was at so that they can be played separately from the video. And we had a session with somebody from India, Manchu, and she was talking about the abuse of wives in India. And funnily enough, in the Irish Times today, here's a little item which says 46% of Indian husbands abuse wives. Nearly half of Indian husbands abuse their wives, either physically or sexually. This is the alarming conclusion of a US study conducted recently in northern India. The survey, published by the Journal of the American Medical Association, is one of the most comprehensive studies of its kind. The data comes from more than 6,000 men interviewed privately in their homes over a two-year period in Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state. This is the state in which a 55-year-old woman earlier this month burned herself to death on her husband's funeral pyre. The practice of suti, outlawed by the British in 1829, is widely seen as the act of a desperate woman who prefers to immolate herself than to face life as a widow. Of the men questioned in the survey, 46% admitted they either beat their wives or abuse them sexually. The survey carried out by the University of North Carolina shows that abuse is more common among men who have extramarital affairs, as well as among those in rural communities or of lower social standing. I'm not at all surprised by the results, said Mrs. Sheila Saravaran. A non-government organization based in Delhi said the real figure could be even higher. Violence against women is a problem all over India, especially in the north, where literacy levels are lower and women are less assertive than in the south. Now, the researcher investigating the status of Indian women said they were less well treated than their counterparts in other South Asian countries. This is because men have taken advantage of Hinduism and our rigid social customs to keep women down, she said. Women in India are made to feel they are inferior to men. Many women even feel it's a man's right to beat a woman. Ms. Saravan disagreed with the survey, finding that violence against women is more prevalent in rural areas and in lower-income groups. She said, abuse of women is a phenomenon which cuts across all castes and classes in Indian society. Still prevalent in India are the practices of female infanticide, child marriage and child burning. The latter occurs frequently in cases where the husband or husband's family are dissatisfied with the wife's behavior or her failure to provide a large enough dowry. The Indian Prime Minister said yesterday the military takeover of Pakistan could lead to an escalation of the 10-year conflict in the Himalayan region of Kashmir. Mr. Vai Pai told a meeting of army commanders they must be on a high state of preparedness. So there's war inside and war outside, as we know. Now, the reason why we're at the United Nations was to try and get other NGOs to understand the importance of the measuring and valuing of the unwaged work. Because until that is known, so we can have surveys about violence, we can have surveys about this, we can have surveys, but there is not an overall survey on the amount of work that women do. And that it is important so that if we know our true value, we can then rectify the economy to suit us and not for the market. So, a few little things from the Irish Times. Public service workers are warned on sell-offs. Public service workers must embrace partnership or face the privatization of their industries. A director of the National Center for Partnership was warned, and he was addressing a conference of public service union members entitled Public Service Partnership, a Trade Union Issue. If trade unionists do not give leadership on the inevitability of change and deliver management of that change through partnership, then they will preside over the privatization of these services. This will happen if for no other reason than pure consumer demand. He said, while there were some pockets of good progress and development in public service reform, he had not seen any great surge of activity in the trade union movement to embrace change. Opening the conference, the Taoiseach, Mr. Hearn, said partnership between employees and management in the private sector was a relatively straightforward concept. Workers and management accepted they had a common interest in ensuring the competitiveness of their companies. The government as employer wishes to see our own staff benefit to the full from opportunities created by a modern and competitive society. Partnership was still at an early stage in the public sector. Miss Deborah King, executive director of the 1199 project in New York, a program established 5 years ago between the city's healthcare workers union and the health industry, said the trade union movement could be a vital force in shaping national public policy if it embraced a changing marketplace. Privatization in the U.S. had caused the loss of 300,000 federal jobs out of a total of 2 million, as well as thousands more state and municipal jobs. If services were privatized, she said, the managerial emphasis was on profit maximization rather than necessarily on quality service provision. To retain the influence, trade unions need to think about what the public needs. Public service workers really do want to contribute and do a high-quality job. The way work has been organized up to now, it has not been up to the workers to think about how best a service can be delivered. Now management and workers need to be open to that concept of involving workers in those kinds of decisions. If the trade union movement doesn't get ahead of this, it is not going to be relevant to people's concerns. If it does, it will become an increasingly vibrant and important force in shaping society. So all of us are out there trying to shape society to suit us and to suit the people. As it is that the market forces, everyone just refers to the work and competitiveness. Now, on a simple thing like drinking water, I always thought drinking water was safe. I suppose you thought drinking water was safe as well. And yet, problems in local supplies highlighted. The quality of local authority water supplies is far higher than that of group and private water schemes. The Environmental Protection Agency nonetheless cited many problems during 1998 through the water supply network. Cavan County Council, numerous breaches of the limits for aluminium, colour and turbidity. Problems likely to persist until deficient overloaded plants are upgraded, replaced. Clare County Council, many cases of excessive fluoride, 3 cases of high lead levels. Cork County Council, problems with high aluminium levels in some northern areas and in isolated cases elsewhere. High nitrate in Carrahmore and Copeen. Donegal County Council group supply is still poor. Dublin Corporation, excessive coliform bacteria levels confined to leak slips supply. Galway County Council, severe problems with public supplies in Roundstone and Kilconnell. Distinct disimprovement in many group supplies, with a lot showing very significant faecal contamination. Kerry County Council, deterioration of public supplies due mainly to coliforms. Kilkenny County Council, numerous cases of excessive fluoride. Mayo County Council, most supplies of good quality, but the remainder distinctly unsatisfactory, notably Bala, Kilmaine, Kilchmar and Newport. Monaghan County Council and in million levels in Inishkeen and Rockcorrie on occasion are gross. Sligo County Council, ongoing problems with fecal bacterial contamination of group schemes. Wexford County Council, problems with non-fecal coliforms in some public supplies. Increased attention is being paid to the occurrence of Treehelm, which includes a suspect carcinogen due to problems when chlorinating coloured water. A few cases where guidelines were exceeded were found in some suppliers in counties Dublin, Donegal, Galway, Meath, Leash and Louth. Now that is absolutely appalling. At the same time, now we are constantly saying people must come first. Survey finds cancer services are inadequate. Workers in EU prefer more time with family. Most workers in the EU would prefer to spend less time at work and more time with their families, according to a new study on attitudes to work. 80% of Irish workers asked why they would prefer to work part-time, said they wanted more time for themselves, and 47% they would like to spend it with their children. Despite all the hype about Celtic Tigers, the study shows that most of us regard work as a necessary evil. The study found that unemployment in the EU was drastically underestimated. The official EU unemployment rate is 8.3%, but the survey found that two-thirds of the 31% of people not in paid employment would like to be. The majority of these are housewives. It is the attitude of those at work, however, which provides some of the most interesting data. Although 13% of EU workers are self-employed, 18% of those interviewed said they would like to be their own boss, and only 38% of workers regarded the options unacceptable. Of those, and so on. A similar pattern emerged when full-time workers were asked if they would prefer to be part-time. While 79% of EU employees work full-time based on the standard working week between 35 and 39 hours, only 35% of those surveyed said this was their preferred option. 11% said they prefer to work longer hours, and 49% they would prefer a shorter working week. However, even those wishing to work longer hours wanted the basic working week reduced to increase their options for time off. At present, only 20% of employees in the EU work 30 hours or fewer a week, but large members said they would seriously review the part-time option if pay rates were increased. All presently employed people want to work 5 hours per week less. Asked why they wanted more time off, 77% of those surveyed said they wanted more time for themselves, and 47% said they want to spend more time with their children. The respective figures for Ireland were 80% and 47%. There was also widespread interest in sabbatical leave, with 57% of employees considering sabbatical leave would be useful to them, but feeling it should not take them away from work for too long. The most popular sabbatical period was 3 months. So everyone is working too hard except for housewives, who are just longing to go to work, and once they do work, then they'll actually find they'll have no time for themselves. So, now, is that we are asking for the public paid holiday, a day off so we can all think about things. A day off, time to think. So, there was quite a bit in the Galway Advertiser. If I can find it, I can't find it at the moment, so I'm going to put something else on. Now, what I thought I would put on is tape from Wings, and naturally enough, it is not wound round properly, so we'll wind it round now. I think there seems to be something else. I'm just putting it in and we'll... Oh, wait now. There are two sides of this, actually, which I didn't realise. So we might be in luck. That's actually the women's news round, which I wasn't... Anyway, shall we do the women's news round? 99. Right, okay, so here we go. Let's see what happens. We really have got to take and make decisions about making sure
Hi y'all, this here's Frieda Worden with Suzette Cullen and Mary O'Grady. We're news wranglers for WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service here in Austin, Texas, USA.
It's International Women's Day, 1999, and we're holding the annual Women's News Roundup, rounding up a few of the hottest women's radio news stories and trends of the past year.
If you stay tuned for about an hour, you'll also find out which story wins this year's Dawn Prize, the Catherine Davenport Award for the hottest women's radio news story of the year.
Hang on now.
Let's start the news roundup with stories about women who made it to really high places.
Well, there's Julia Butterfly out in California. She spent the entire year in an old-growth redwood tree defending it against commercial loggers.
And she hasn't come down yet.
Julia talked by cell phone with Joan Buffington of local community radio station KVMR-FM in Nevada City, California.
The noise in the background is a helicopter that's logging this hillside. It basically creates a whirlwind exactly like a tornado directly below it and twists the trees up like rubber bands, ripping branches completely off of them. Any kind of life that existed in the treetops before can no longer exist there now.
You're in the Stafford Giant, which is one very old, very large redwood tree. What's left around you?
They actually didn't come in here and clear cut, which was good. They have cut most of the older growth trees that were left up here, although there's still a few remaining because they weren't able to cut them because we're here. There's some that were attached to, and there are ones around us that they couldn't fall because we were in the way. But mostly it's third growth trees and second growth trees around us.
2 weeks later, Julia Butterfly continued to protect the tree. When we last talked to you a couple weeks ago, we could hear the helicopter above you. You were describing the floodlights beneath you, put there by Pacific Lumber, the owner of the tree, and you described the security people around you.
Right.
So you're telling us that basically the security people who were there to secure the tree against you were unable to keep supplies from getting to you. Is that correct?
That's right. The weather was really bad, and all they had down there basically is the same thing I have up here, which was some tarps. And it was too much, and I guess they decided they couldn't be effective against us, so they pulled out.
How much longer do you see staying up there? It's 60-some days now.
I plan on staying here as long as I can be effective. The storms really, really beat me down pretty hard. My exhaustion level has been rather high. But this tree and this cause and these people that I'm working with are so incredible that I feel rejuvenated. My first major storm I went through, I spent my whole time praying to the great spirits and to every power that controls this universe to save my life because I was extremely afraid that I was going to die. And in the second major storm, I was able to pull my attention off of myself, which was great. And I started praying for everybody that I could think of. Any person that came into my mind, I prayed for them instead of for myself because it was able to take my attention off of the storms. And then the last one that I went through every emotion because it was so incredibly intense because my fort collapsed on me and the major branches were breaking off all around me and I was getting thrown in the air from all the turbulence. And what I did each time is when I started to lose it, I wrapped my arms around parts of this tree that we call Luna, the Stafford Giant. And I just spoke to her and expressed to her my fears and my fact that I felt like I was going insane. And she told me to go ahead and let it go. That in a windstorm, the trees don't try and stay rigid. They don't try and stay strong and straight. They bend with the wind and they allow the wind to blow them around. And she said, go ahead and let it go. Go ahead and let the wind blow you. Go ahead and go crazy. Just let it all go because I'm here, I'm holding you, and you're loved and you're safe. And it was absolutely amazing.
Okay, I admit that Julia Butterfly is one of our friends in high places, but I thought you meant high places in politics.
Well, would you admit that the presidency is a pretty high position?
Okay, I would.
And would you admit that Switzerland is a very high place?
Okay, I'll admit it.
So, let's listen to this story about the first woman president of Switzerland, reported by Imogen Folks of Swiss Radio International.
Gewählt ist mit 158 Stimmen Frau Ruth Dreifuss.
When the election result was announced, there was euphoria among the hundreds of women gathered outside Parliament. Among them was Gabriela Winkler, General Secretary of the Swiss Association of Women's Organizations.
For me personally, it's a very great day. The position of President of the government is an important one. Symbolically, it makes a difference to see the first time a woman representing our country outside and inside.
When Ruth Dreyfus herself came out of the parliament to speak to the waiting women, she was toasted with champagne. Miriam Holzner is secretary of the women's section of the Social Democratic Party.
we have been celebrating throughout the whole year now, 150 years of the modern Switzerland. And now at the end of the celebrating year, we finally have the first woman as head in the government. So, which also shows us that we are still at the beginning. Ruth Dreyfus is still alone in the government, and we want much more. We want half women everywhere.
And Ruth Dreyfus herself agrees. She has said becoming president is the realization of a personal dream, but it is not a sign that Swiss women have achieved full equality.
This election in the last year of the century is really the symbol. It doesn't mean that equality is realized. It doesn't mean that social policy is satisfactory, but it does mean that we have now all tools to change the society, and the society needs to be changed.
You know, the next president of Russia might have been a woman if Galina Starovoytova hadn't been assassinated last year. Sarah Harder, who works with feminists in Russia, recalled Starovoytova for Wings.
Galina Starovoytova was 52 years old. She had been a very outspoken human rights activist before the collapse of the Soviet Union. She swept into office initially in the early democratic surges, but she had lost in the elections of 93 when Russians began to wonder whether democracy was absolutely equivalent with the rapacious 19th century capitalism, bringing crime to their streets and crime into their largest institutions. She said, any revolution inevitably devours its own children. And we, the Democrats, should recognize that this is true, even of our peaceful ones. But what we want to do now is to save the freedom to vote, the parliamentary system, the freedom of expression, the freedom of the press. Galina was ambushed along with her aide as she was walking into her apartment building in St. Petersburg on the night of Friday, November 20th. She had just left Moscow, where she was a member of the State Duma, which is the equivalent of the Congress of the United States. She had just spoken out against a prominent Communist Party member who was making many really horrible anti-Semitic remarks, and she asked, as a matter of fact, that he be rebuked by the State Duma, but in its Communist Party majority, it did not, in fact, carry on that rebuke. Amnesty International has said that the reason for her murder was her outspoken criticism of corruption among the political elite. My friend Suzanne Gilbert has been in Novgorod running a program training women business leaders. She reported, people in Novgorod feel the hit came from very high in the government and that the murderers will never be caught. My friend Tatiana Barchanova lives in the Siberian city of Novosibirsk, and Tatiana and I have an email relationship, but we've worked together in building women's coalitions in the cities of Russia. And she wrote to me, we considered Galina Starovoytova the most important person in the democratic movement. She was the only one for whom I was collecting signatures when she was running for president. When she was part of the president's team, she was against Chechnya. She predicted how disastrous this war would be. And she was completely objective, no hidden agenda. Her death, says Tatiana, has knocked me down. I had a small heart seizure after watching the funerals on the TV. She's everything I had always wanted to be. December 6th, when elections were held in St. Petersburg, there were lines of people coming to that apartment riddled with bullet holes and mounding it with crosses and flowers. One man was quoted by saying that he will use his vote to avenge the murder of Starovoytova. But the elections were as crazy as everything is in Russia these days. There were 50 assembly seats in the St. Petersburg election, and more than 600 people running for these seats, many of them with pretended names aimed at deliberately confusing the situation. Impoverished people cast their votes in exchange for a few rubles. But there was a sign in her hallway that says, "Forgive us, Galia. Please forgive us that we did not manage to save you. You live in a diseased, stinking country."
Bella Abzug died last year, too. Here's your story on her, Frida.
On March 31st, Bella died following heart surgery. It was her lungs that failed. They'd been a great resource of the women's movement.
It's unacceptable to rape women. It's unacceptable to endure violence against women from the streets of Algeria to the abortion clinics here, from our homes or in Bosnia or Rwanda. It is unacceptable that over 500,000 women die every year worldwide from pregnancy, unsafe abortions, or in childbirth. It's unacceptable that the genitals of young girls are mutilated every day. And it is unacceptable that here in the United States, we cut age-dependent children while increasing age-dependent corporations and age-dependent military contractors.
Born a month before U.S. women got the vote, rejected by Harvard Law because she was female, Bella went to Columbia and became a civil rights and labor lawyer. Her husband, Martin, suggested she wear a hat so people would recognize her as that rare thing, a woman professional. So she made huge, outrageous hats, a lifelong trademark. In 1961, Bella co-founded Women's Strike for Peace, which pitted women against nuclear weapons. Years later, as a breast cancer survivor, she still supported human life against such technology.
And if I had to choose between the power of nuclear energy and the power of women when they are angry and determined to change policies, I'm with the women.
In 1970, at age 50, Bella was elected the first Jewish woman in the U.S. Congress.
The slogan when I first ran for Congress was, "This woman's place is in the House of Representatives." And when I was elected election night, my older daughter got up and said, "Thank God we got her out of our house into their house." But I have great family and great love.
Her first congressional speech denounced the Vietnam War. She supported women, the poor, and gay rights, and yet was voted one of the three most influential members of the Congress. After three terms, her enemies got her out by redrawing the boundaries of her Manhattan district. One bill Bella passed provided $5 million for U.S. women to draw up a national women's plan of action.
The right wing invaded our meetings and sought to overcome us. And indeed, they represented 20% of the delegates at that convention. We listened to them, but we know that we will never allow them to overpower us.
Abzug then chaired the President's Commission on the Status of Women, which was rebuked by Carter for criticizing his budget.
We said, you know, you've got all this increase in the military program and you're cutting the women's program. And our issue was that every issue is a woman's issue and that the budget is the value system of the nation. And since it's the value system of the nation, we are going to comment on it.
Aides convinced Carter that firing the loudmouth would help the president's ratings in the press.
And, of course, I got on every television talk show. And so we then had an opportunity to explain what the women's movement was about.
Still broadening women's issues, Bella formed and chaired the Women's Foreign Policy Council and turned her attention to influencing the United Nations.
We're not going to ask for much. But for starters, a lot of talk has been made here about women's participation in decisions. So we suggest no more than 60%. Or less than 40% of either sex should be included in leadership posts in the United Nations, its specialized agencies and programs, in governments and public policy-making groups in every region in the world, and especially in the member delegations